You're listening to Seek Up, the Yoga Inspiration Show, right here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. I'm Kina McGregor, your host, world-renowned yoga teacher, author of multiple books, and founder of Om Stars, the world's first online TV channel. Get ready to raise your vibration and dive into the spiritual lessons from the yoga tradition. Even if you've never practiced yoga before, you'll find kernels of wisdom to help make your world a happier and more peaceful place. So let's dive in. Let's seek up and leave with a little dose of inspiration.
Hi, welcome to the Fighting Harmony Podcast. I'm here with Russell and someone who needs no introduction.
I guess we have like a Miami native on the show. This is maybe our third Miami native. I'm so excited.
Nice.
Hi, Kina. Well, how are you?
Hey, Harmony. Hey, Russell. I'm good. I'm just awake from my after practice nap and feeling pretty good that I made it through practice today.
Yeah, much needed, it sounds like. You're all the way over there in India right now.
First trip here since before the pandemic.
Wow.
And seriously, you're waking up at like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock?
So my alarm is set for 1:30 in the morning, and that gives me half an hour to brush my teeth, take a shower, make tea, which I never managed to finish because the time is too short. And then I do my sitting practice. So I sit from 2 to like 3:05 or 3:10. And then I have another 10 minutes before our car comes to collect my stuff and just put it in the bag and get on over to practice.
But what about like a warm-up? Like you got to be able to like move all your limbs around, do a little pigeon.
A little pigeon.
Do all your emails and pigeon.
She doesn't need a warm-up.
You don't do all the little things? I had to do hours of that stuff.
To be honest with you, at that, I feel I've reduced everything to during when I do the metta practice, I lie back with my legs up like Vipriyata Karani. Yeah. And then I do metta practice lying down because I'm really tired. Yeah. And, you know, the whole instruction with metta bhavana is like, you should relax your body and be comfortable. Mm-hmm. So I do like Vipriyata Karani for metta for like 5 to 10 minutes after the 1 hour sit. And then I do a forward bend because I've been sitting for an hour. Yeah. And then I usually do one handstand against the wall to keep the vertical axis, because that like vertical axis training is super important. So like the handstand training I've done with the few handstand trainers that I've worked with, the thing to keep the vertical line really consistent is to do, you know, the go as close to the wall as you can and basically like fingertips against the wall. And then you just move. So I just go up for 10 breaths of protraction and retraction of the shoulders. And then I come down and I'm ready to go. And it just takes like 30 seconds. And then I'm like, get me out. And honestly, I do that here because there's so much emphasis on like flexibility. Mm-hmm. And especially with the deep back bends that we end up doing here, that I feel like I lose the strength really quickly. So I just do like one handstand against the wall to like keep the strength. And then I go and practice, but I don't do really too much because there's not enough time.
Yeah,
that's I would find that really frustrating. I found
you'd be up at like 11 p.m. just to like warm up for your practice.
The moment that I woke up, I always have been overwhelmed with a feeling of anxiety about practicing, and so I found myself, I mean, really like 2.5 hours of prep, whether it was, you know, anything you could imagine. I mean, like third series postures, anything that I could open up my psoas, open up my shoulders, open up my hips, open up my everything. And then I always felt like right around hour two, the anxiety was just beginning to fade.
Because you're exhausted.
And I was exhausted. And then I felt like, okay, I can go into practice and I'm not going to hurt myself and I'm going to be okay. And I felt like that. There was nothing I could do about that. It was just my personality was in my own way. Mm-hmm. I mean, does that jive at all with your experience of practice? Like, do you feel like you wake up and you can, it's going to be okay?
I mean, I think that my sitting practice is really the benchmark of my sanity. So for me, I know that if I don't sit, I don't want to engage with the public of any type, even my, and any other human being, probably any other even being, like even an animal being. I feel like I just want to, I want to not talk to anyone and get on my, and do my meditation. And after my meditation, I feel like whatever happens, I'll be okay. And so for me, my sitting practice is really the key. And so that's why I'm getting up early, because I know that I want to sit before I practice. I want to sit before I interact with other people. And there's a lot of interaction at the shala, even at that really early hour. And when you're finished with practice, and there's a lot of kind of, you know, just negotiating people's space and sharing space and in the changing rooms and the closing area and in and out. And, you know, so I feel like I'm, for me, it's my sitting practice. You know, there's a lot, and then the second thing is, the earlier start time. So if I had another 30, 45 minutes, I'd probably find something to do. You know, I'd probably like do a little pigeon and lie there and like relax a little bit. Like I do my practice at home. I sit and then I do 15, 20 minutes of yin as kind of like a transition in between the world of meditation and the sort of dynamic world of Ashtanga. But yeah, I don't have the time. So I'm like, all right, paper to karani, handstand against the walls, get out of here, because that's all the time I've got. And I feel like if I were to cut my meditation and do more stretches, then that wouldn't be good for my mental health. And for me, I always prioritize my mental health over, you know, what I can or can't do physically. And I just feel like it'll be okay. You know, and this is something that I think is kind of problematic about the way people approach the practice here, is that they think that that they have to perform at 100% capacity every single day. And they think it's not going to be okay if they need to adapt a posture, modify a posture, or skip a posture one day. And there's like this kind of push to be at your best and be at this achievement. But the reality of it is that that's something that many people we bring. And if we can have the courage to go and, you know, talk to the assistants, talk to Sharad and figure out like, well, hey, today I'm not feeling great, or to share that and think, okay, well, what's going on? And actually like open up a line of communication that that's possible. And then also just to decide, look, I don't want to do, like, maybe I'm just going to do primary today, or maybe I'm going to just do everything really lightly today, and that's okay. And so I feel like if people can give themselves that permission, then I think it can kind of lessen the anxiety a little bit. Now at the shala, I was really surprised to see that there are laminated cards on the stage at the front. And they say, I don't need help today. That says, that's one of the cards.
Really?
And then the second card says, I have an injury. And then the next card says, I'm pregnant. So, and I've seen people take the pregnancy
card. Oh, I grabbed that one.
Yeah, exactly. I told him, I think you should go grab the pregnancy one.
Just see what happens.
Yeah. That explains a lot.
It certainly does.
But I've seen people, like, there's a girl who has some like a wrap around her ankle. She's obviously sprained her ankle somehow. And so she gets that every day. She walks over and grabs, I have an injury. There's someone that hurt their knee doing a pose. And so then now they're grabbing this, I have an injury thing and putting it in front of their mat in the lead classes and the Mysore classes. And so people are aware of it. And I think that I think that's nice that there's space for that now. Yeah. And I hope that that creates a sort of more kind of relaxed atmosphere about what we can allow ourselves not to do, you know?
I remember one time, in Gokulam, you came out of the shala and you told me something had happened. It's a really good story. I don't know if you remember it, but you had said to me, this is one of those days where all I wanted to do was do, you know, maybe three sun salutations, Padmasana, and go back to bed. And I was felt that way walking into the shala, you told me. And what ended up happening was Guruji just randomly started teaching you a fifth series posture in the middle of third series. Because he thought it'd be really funny to show you. And it's like you do the splits, and then you have to reach back for your foot.
I remember
that. And it was like, this is bananas. What do you, I mean, I just, What I liked about the story is how honest you were, or just forthright you were about, like, there are days where we don't need to do everything.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I felt like that this morning, to be honest with you. I felt like, oh, this is miserable. You know, I told Tim on the way over. We didn't say anything on the way over. We're like, so we're sharing a car with Anna from San Antonio, mm-hmm. who's hosted us a bunch of times over there and been coming here for like 10 years or so. And sometimes we chat in the morning and all three of us were just silent in the car over there. We're just like staring out the window. And, like, oh. And then I really thought like, how am I going to do this? I had this feeling today also, like, mm-hmm. I don't even want to do the sun salutations. I was like, I just want a bolster and like a long hold in Supta Baddha Konasana and a bath. Yeah. That's what I want
and
today.
A bath. Nice. I've been taking a lot of those.
I want a bath. And then I want to go back to bed.
Yeah.
And then I started, you know, it was so cold this morning and I started, I'm like, okay, actually my body's warming up. And I'm like, okay, the muscles are warming up. And then, you know, Jadaji walks into the room and I'm like, all right. And he's literally stood in front of my mat for like 20 minutes. And I was like, okay, you're giving me energy. I'm going to ride that energy. And I was like, wow, this is really helpful that you're standing there. And I was thinking that. And I was just like, okay, this is good. Like, stand there because I'm trying because he's standing there. And I could do so much more than I thought. And I was actually thinking, how grateful I feel to have a teacher, to be in a space where I want to come. And I'm like, I'm not pushing myself beyond limits, but I'm like, oh, my body warmed up and I could do so much more than I thought. But if I was at home, I totally wouldn't have done it. And so I was really grateful in that moment. And something like that day that you're talking about in that story, it was like the same thing. I'm there. And then, you know, suddenly that day, you know, Patami Joyce is going to come over and start like talking to me and doing all kinds of weird things with me. And today I also had this feeling like, please, I really don't need any help with any asanas today. I would like to just be in my own circle of misery, if that's okay. Exist with what I can do and let that be enough. And I thought that was going to happen. I was even like, please let one of the assistants come over, because, you know, when the assistants come over, then I can like, I mean, like, you know, it's like when I have when I'm in Mysore class at home with our teachers in Miami, I'm kind of like, I'm the one that's still in control, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they're my students, then I'm like teaching them. I'm like, all right, so today we're going to hold here. So I've decided. Yeah. And then I'm like training them. So I'm never fully surrendered. I'm like, oh, actually, you know, you didn't follow the arc of the shoulder. Let's try to do that again. You know, and it's the teaching moment. And then with the assistants here, I'm like, this is a holiday. So we're just going to do what I can do by myself. While they're standing there, and that's going to be nice, and it's going to be a holiday. And so I was like, please let me have holiday today. And absolutely not. This was not happening. And then, you know, I have a posture that's at the end. It's also in fifth series that I just can't, like, I can't do it without help. And I just felt like, okay, I'm not like, I don't want help in this today. I just want to do my miserable version of it and move on with my life. And then, you know, like Chatterjee walks over immediately and is like, let's do it now. And I was like, holy crap. Okay, let's do it now.
What does it look like?
I think it's called Padma Dandasana. And so it's the Chaturanga Dandasana with the lotus. So like,
down and float into that.
Down is actually is not so bad. It's the getting up to go down that's actually really bad.
Right. And do you start in lotus to go up, or do you go into lotus?
You jump through, take Utlutahi, and then you're supposed to lift up like into handstand and then lower down. I've never been able to figure out that lift up from Utlutahi. So I'm just so the poor man has to come over and lift me up and take me down. So I'm like, I don't need you to break your back. You're like, let's just skip this today. It'll be fine. I have some miserable version I can do on my own that like kind of touches the bookends of the pose. And I was like,
right.
And I did that and lied down. I was like, this is fine. And you know what I mean? And I was like, I don't really need help with back bends today. Oh, you're going to stand there while I do the whole thing. Okay. All right. I guess the assistants are not coming. And then it was fine. I was, you know, and it's interesting that on one of these days where you really feel like, I just want to do Surya Namaskar and standing, particularly what I found here in Mysore, on those days, if you come, that's the day that they're going to be there for you. You know, that's the day that they're going to come and stand around your mat, and they'll just like be there. And the day that you feel like, wow, I'm kind of hot shit today. Like, look, I feel really good. Like, wow. Like, they don't see you. You don't exist to them. You know?
And it's so weird, like, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah. No, you feel, oh, I did everything today. And then they, and then that's the day that like, he'll come back and be like, oh, I didn't see you. Do again. And you can't do it again. You know? Like, that was it. It was a once in a lifetime experience, like a comet, and it's over.
I feel like one of the through lines that's coming through our conversation is this kind of motif of transformation. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of when I first met you, like I first actually started meeting, like talking to you in India, but when I first, you know, met you or saw you, I was, I think, at Guy's place in New York, and you had a shaved head, and you had this, you know, astounding practice, and I'm like looking over like, who the fuck is that? And then I had heard someone mentioned to me in passing that you were getting like a master's degree in civil engineering or something like that.
Studies, but from NYU. Yeah.
Okay. But was civil engineering a part of interdisciplinary studies?
No. Interdisciplinary studies allows you to take kind of an intersectional look at different topics and it allows you, what was really nice about this degree is it allows you access to all of the graduate degree programs at New York University. So you can pick and choose what's relevant to give you a truly holistic view of whatever your course of study is. And so what my degree was in, I did a combination of an anthropological, political science, and feminist studies view to of the science of agriculture. So, and this allowed me to apply kind of a deconstructivist lens to the kind of epistemological bias that goes into the science of agriculture. And what you'll find in a lot of agricultural writing is a feminization of the earth and plants, and a masculinization of the sort of the means by which production is achieved. And the language begins to be very, very different depending on which type of agricultural processes are being worked in different farms. So if it's large scale commercial agriculture versus organic agriculture versus a more kind of like what's called biodynamic agriculture, then the whole language that goes into the relationship between the sort of human activity and the nature activity, it radically changes.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Wow. That's so fascinating. That's fascinating. Yeah. Do you feel
and
like...
I can see why I came up with the idea of like city engineering, because I was like, what is she doing? It's like, she's creating society.
I was also working as a journalist, and I wrote a few articles about kind of, you know, like New York City. And so I did actually... work. I wrote an article about garbage in Gotham and I interviewed, you know, like the head comptroller of Manhattan, who was in charge of all of the garbage. And so, like, I was also working as a journalist. So maybe maybe some of the pieces that I wrote came in as well. And yeah, I mean, right. I thought I was going to have a totally different like life, and then yoga kind of
right.
came in.
That's amazing.
And so there was that. There's this piece and this woman that I met or was next to at Guy's place. And then I think maybe 2 years later, I was standing there talking to Petri. And to my left, I remember seeing Tim. And then I remember seeing a goddess next to Tim. And I'm like, I looked at the goddess and she was like, really like a Athena, like a rippling, muscled... It's like Olympian, and I thought, and I like,
but a tiny one.
But I'm a visual learner, right? So I don't get things visually. I was studying painting in New York, and like, fuck me, that's Kino. That's the Kino lady.
That's the Kino lady.
And I went up and I introduced myself afterward, and it was like that. I wanted to ask you about that transformation, but I feel like there's so many of these transformations that have happened in your life. I mean, you wrote a book, Sacred Fire, My Journey into Ashtanga Yoga. Maybe that sets up what this transformation was like for you. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I never did anything physical before yoga. So I was never a dancer. I was never a gymnast. I was never anything physical. So I feel like when I started the practice, I was kind of like, maybe you'll appreciate from the artist perspective, I felt like I was really like a blank canvas. But rather than a blank canvas being like given to a master, I was like a blank canvas given to someone with absolutely no skills. And I felt like I was blind and deaf and lacked kinesthetic touch. And it was like, okay, here, now start working.
It's like Plato's cave. Here we are. Okay.
I felt like that. I felt like I have no sense of where anything is and no sense of like the whole felt sense of the body was something completely foreign to me. And I think it took me years to realize that was really one of the benefits of the yoga asana practice, is to bring you deeper into contact with that subtlety of the felt sense of the body and all the different kind of levels of awareness and that can come in when you fully inhabit your physical form. And I think that for a long time, I just didn't know why, but I felt better after doing asana practice. Mm-hmm. And I felt, you know, more peaceful, more whole. And particularly after my first trip to India, I really didn't know more other than I want to get back and continue the practice. I didn't think I wanted to be, I definitely didn't think I wanted to be a yoga teacher. I definitely didn't think I wanted to stop my sort of educational path. But then I came back for 6 months, and then I came back for another 6 months. And then, you know, very soon it was like, well, you should teach. And then I just felt like I want to keep coming back as much as I can. And then, you know, and then then that path just kind of sort of opened ahead of me. And I still think about potentially going back and completing a PhD, but my interests have radically changed. So, you know, I've really, really thought about that over the last couple of years. And I still might, you know, life's not over. You still have, you know, half life left to go or so. But I think that the first thing maybe what you saw physically was kind of like the first outlines of a different body on a canvas. Because I had... I mean, like muscle development and that kind of thing. I had zero when I started the practice. I couldn't do chaturanga to save my life. I fell out of triangle pose, like trikonasana, in my first class that I ever went to. It took me a year to do a headstand. Like, I just had no muscle development at all. So it really was just kind of like blank blob. And it felt like that when I was practicing. I was like, I'm a blob and the blob needs to do something. So let's try. And over time it was like, oh, that's the blob is differentiating. Like the blob has at least a top and a bottom now. And then slowly there's more information, more awareness. And I was never, you might remember from many years ago, but when I started practice, there was not really a lot of technique and anatomy. There was more like mysticism. And I felt like at some moment, because I felt like my lived experience with the body was just this blob, I felt like I need some anatomical information. So I started to like really get some anatomical information, some study anatomy. And I was really familiar with the course of like being a student. So I did a lot of self-study just in terms of body awareness and figuring out like what, like I can't activate my shoulder. So what does that involve? And so like looking up the muscles of the shoulder and figuring out what they do and what are the bones like. And I mean, I regretted that I slept through biology class in high school because I just felt like that seems like it'd be the one thing from high school to be useful. And that's the class I didn't really like. So I just ignored it. You know, I thought this is useless. And then I was like, oh, this is, I gotta figure out where subscapularis is. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. What was it then that like brought you into the practice? Was it looking for a physical outlet or was it?
Did a friend drag you in?
What was it that attracted you?
No, I mean, well, I did my first yoga class when I was 19 and it was in a gym. It was a traditional hatha yoga class from the Shivananda tradition. So I did some hatha yoga that was just kind of really spiritual oriented, relaxation based. And so it was like, you know, I really, really respect that lineage. I think it's a really great entry for people who have no kind of body awareness and no physical training. I think this traditional hatha practice is wonderful, especially if people are looking for deep relaxation and this sort of thing. Really, really respect this. And I, you know, was in a radically different period of my life. So from the time I'm 18 until I start really doing dedicated Ashtanga yoga, I can look back now and I can see that I was in a period of depression. You know, I was in a period where I was searching without having the tools for searching. And that led me into while I'm, you know, going into, you know, education, I'm in every spare moment kind of like undergraduate school for me for somehow was very non-challenging. So that allowed me to basically excel in the undergraduate degree while at the same time having like a part-time job partying. So right. I felt like I was, you know, doing what I needed to do. And I graduated with honors. I was going to double major, but I changed my mind and did three minors instead. That allowed me more diversity and to explore different things. And so then at the same time, I was living this life where it would come like Thursday through Sunday, and I would just be completely lost in another world. And it was in that atmosphere that I did my first yoga class. And at some moment, I graduated from my undergraduate degree, and I wanted to take a little bit of time off because I felt really lost. And it was during this period where I was applying to graduate schools, and I said, I want to get more deeply into yoga. And I remember thinking, I know exactly where it came from, because I was standing in an elevator. This is going to sound completely bizarre, but standing in an elevator on Monday morning. I hadn't been to sleep since Friday, Thursday night, actually. So then I was standing in an elevator and there's a guy who came in and I'm 21 and standing in an elevator. And it's a guy with these like tattoos of kisses all over his neck. Yeah. This guy looks really gnarly, you know, like really gnarly. Yeah. And I was a little bit like, I'm going to an after party. I'm like an after party because I don't have class until Tuesday, so I'm still free. And I'm standing in the elevator and I'm looking up at this guy and I'm like, is this really like, is this safe? You know,
right.
I'm by myself
for sure.
I know where the party is and I know the people there and I've like gone from one place to another. And he looks down at me and he's like, man, I'm so glad the 80s are over. And I was like, the 80s? That was in my childhood. Like, I didn't have any problem with the 80s. Like, I'm thinking, and I immediately have all these images flash through my mind about the 80s. So I see like Michael Jackson and Madonna and Van Halen. And I'm like, I don't really have a problem with that. And he's like, man, all those eight balls were just killing me. And I was a little bit like, oh my God.
Totally.
You know, it's an eight ball if anybody's just like cocaine and heroin. And I was like, okay. And then like he takes a breath and he's like, yeah, man, this ecstasy is just so much better for the body. And I was like, absolutely. I need to stop this right now.
For the children at home, agree with every comment so far.
Yeah. I just had this image in my mind. I was like, listen, I nodded him and was like, you need to get out of this party scene. You get your life back together. You are clearly on some path of deep escapism. You are not happy within yourself. This is where you are. And in 20 years, you have a choice. You're either going to be the female version of that dude or you're going to be his girlfriend. So, which is worse? You need to just, you know, like, get out of this. And we still went to the party. I still had a really good time. Yeah. But I also realized, like, there was a hollowness into, you know, trying to find eternal happiness in the perfect house music beat. You know what I mean? Like, it just, like, you keep looking and the goalposts just shift, but the misery that's inside, it never leaves you, because you'll have a chemically induced kind of period of happiness, but you always come back to yourself. You always come back to the down. And so I literally said, I want to find out how to live a more peaceful life. And part of that was, I want to go to take a more serious yoga class. So I walked into an Ashtanga class. I didn't know what it was. And within, like, I think I bought my ticket to India 6 months after my first Ashtanga class.
Wow.
And I showed up in India like 8 months into my Ashtanga journey.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Were you in New York in that first class?
My first class was in Miami, and then I was moving to New York. My first Mysore class was in New York. I think you saw me at Guy's when I came back from Mysore for the first time. So I'd already been to India for 2 months. I did the 1 month after 9/11 in the Puck building, you know, there, which was really emotional and really intense. And I actually started coming to Guy's, and maybe you'll think this is quite funny, because I was practicing on my own in my East Village apartment in Alphabet City, which this was radically different 20 years ago than it is now.
Right. You could still buy eight balls at that point.
Exactly. I was living in a very bizarre building. Like, there were like seances happening and like, you know, like naked tarot readings. And then I would be like yoga girl. And then like people like invited me, like, do you want to come and be a part of our naked tarot? I was like, I'm good, but have fun, you know, next time.
Keep my options open now. Keep my schedule open.
Absolutely. Naked tarot and seances. What more could you ask for out of
not much.
Apartment mates, you know, your neighbors, right? Yeah. So I
But you're only like two or three blocks from Guy's place.
But I was practicing by myself, so I felt like I met my teachers. You know, like I have my teachers. And I had so much physical like activity to be a student at NYU. Because, you know, like NYU is that east-west commute. So I'm living in Alphabet City, and I was just like, all right.
20-minute walk back and forth.
Yeah, like, walk 20 minutes over here, and I went 20 minutes back, and I'm going to walk over here. I went to Eddie's for like a week, and I was like, I'm going to walk-a-thon. I can't do this, and I don't have money for cabs. Because like there was no subway transportation. And I like walked there. I was like 40-minute there, 40-minute back, 20-minute there, 20-minute back. And at the end, I was like, I don't have money to feed myself for all of this. Like, I can't. I'm going to walk-a-thon. So I was like, look, I already have a teacher. I'm good. I went to Eddie because he was the host at the Puck building, and I felt that's right. And then I'm like, look, he's not my teacher. Patavi Joyce was my teacher. I felt really connected with with Sharad even then. And I was like, they're my teacher. We practice at home, practicing at home. Then, one Sunday morning, I got a fierce knock on my door. Boom, boom, boom. I was like, ah, and I'm practicing, you know? And like, I opened the door. And I got this neighbor who looks super hungover with like, you know, like the mascara, like coming out. She's like, what are you doing in here? And I'm like, I'm doing yoga. Like, what are you doing?
The sound upset your neighbors.
Yeah. And she's like, I'm sleeping. I was like, she said she would hear her chandelier like boom, boom. But I guess I'm just jumping.
The jumping.
And then I was, and she was And she's like, classic New Yorker was like, yoga is supposed to be relaxing. Like, what is your problem? Why are you jumping? You should be relaxing. Go and relax. And she like walked away. I was like, I'm really sorry.
On Sundays, I'll
find someplace else to do my practice. So then that's how I started going to guys. I was like, just once a week on Sunday, I will go and practice somewhere so that I don't see that image again.
That's exactly what I saw. It was on a Sunday. Yeah, it wasn't every day. Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, wow.
Because, you know, you get one New Yorker up in your face in the middle of your practice. It's almost like a PTSD moment. You know what I mean?
Totally. You're like, I don't need any more of that.
She was super hungover. And to be honest with you, it was a really old building. And that chandelier could have fallen off. It could have injured someone. So, let it happen when no one was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's really the moment then. I mean, that's, you were on your way to a PhD in, and really going in a really very deeply academic path. And then this is it now. This is the, you went that direction and now Indian, here you are.
An India detour that's lasted 20 some odd years.
You're in Mysore on Zoom talking to us. I mean, that's the result of that choice.
I really never thought that I would be a teacher, to be honest with you. It wasn't really like, you know, like there's so many people now that come to Mysore and they're like, they want the authorization as part of their career path or something like that. And, you know, it's like a different time. There was like authorization was kind of like something relatively new. And then it was signed up.
Kimberly
like,
came sort of, up with.
It was like, okay, so was someone, something happened on the way to certification, you know?
Right.
It was kind of like, should you be teaching? Should you not be teaching? Like what, you know, it was like this whole kind of this different community of people that were like, okay, we're just here to practice.
I wasn't even sure I wanted to spend the whole $100 on it. I was like, that's a lot of money. Is it like $5,000 now? Did I hear that?
$3,000? I heard it's like
a lot
I
really of money.
I don't know. I could ask some people. Some like I mentioned before. So three people from Miami, two of our teachers, and one member of our community all got the authorization this time. I think they were like, you know, now there's like levels. You can get like level one. You can like upgrade to level two. I don't think there's level three. And then
did you say level one with upgrades?
You can get upgraded to level two.
Oh, you get, but not within, not between one and two. There's not like a one A, one
B. Sometimes I think he does like level two up to Dweepot or
something. Yeah. So then you can complete exactly.
Yeah.
So you do that. And actually, on the certification, now I don't know what the certification looks like, but the one that I got, there's a place. It's like India is very interesting, right? So then, like to get the cert, when I got the certification, there are all these interesting things that they asked me for, like my father's name. Yeah. So actually, on the certification, it says daughter of John McGregor.
Yeah,
because that's my dad's name. Within India, they can that's part of the whole. Like it actually ties into some kind of really interesting and troubling things about India's past, because this can also like your father's name determines your caste.
Yeah.
So that, but
that's your caste.
So my dad's name is on my certification, and there's supposed to be a place where it indicates class level. Right. And Lino Miele from Italy, he was there the day I got my certification. First thing he did was like, let me see. And he was like super Italian. He's like, I want to see the certification. And I was like, okay. And he's like, oh, it looked like mine, except for one other thing. And I was like, oh, and he's like, this blank. And so apparently they had written in like the level that he was on. And for me, that's a
play. Oh, interesting.
So Lino was done. He was cooked and you were yet to be fully baked.
You're still going.
There's still room there.
This is good for you. You can
this is a good
more.
For you, yeah. Bella. Bueno. Wow.
I feel like another really interesting thing that shifted, and we were talking a little bit about this at the beginning, about how dedicated you are to your meditation practice and how it really creates that mental stability. Because I remember when we met for the first time was in 2004, and it was at like Ken, I think, was having some kind of party on his house.
Yeah.
And we started talking like on his roof, and you were just leaving, and I had just kind of got there, and we'd both been in Srivara Manor for a little bit, and there was like, you know, a lot of drama.
The palace.
And you were like, oh, I can't wait to sleep in. I can't be getting up at 1 a.m. in the morning. We had this whole conversation.
And then the next time we met, I forget, it might have been 2005 or six, but and your personality was like, had kind of totally changed in a way. It was like so much more, I'm going to say peaceful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like, it was like really apparent, like that your energy had like really shifted. And we were talking again and you were telling me about doing the Vipassana retreat, like mm-hmm. you're after your first one and how it like just changed everything for you and it really shifted things. Can yeah. you tell us a little bit about like what that was like for you? How that, yeah. how you think like that path really kind of
shifted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Helped like added to the yeah. Ashtanga practice.
I feel like without my sitting practice, I don't know if I'd still be practicing asanas today, to be honest with you. And I feel like I've been sitting for almost as long as I've been doing asanas. So I had a friend of mine who introduced me to traditional Buddhist studies. My grandfather was Buddhist, but he never taught me. I think I was too young to learn much about the teachings from him and before he passed away. But I have a really good friend who took monastic vows. His monk name is Tenzin Senge. Mm-hmm. And we were part of kind of the same community in Miami. And he shared with me a lot of the teachings that he got from his lama and some basics about meditation. So I was kind of like sitting without a lot of guidance. I asked Patabi Joyce if I could go and do the meditation retreat. And he said, sure, you know, go ahead. And he actually said,
yes, yes.
Yeah. And he said, I told him I was going to Nepal and he was like, oh, maybe you'd not come back. And yeah. And you know, it's interesting because I do feel like I wasn't the same person after I left that retreat.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's true. I didn't come back. That being that I was, that being didn't come back. And wow. I really felt like, so the way that that course kind of changed my relationship with myself, my mind. It did open a path to more holism. It did open a path to bringing kind of the intelligence and wisdom of kind of what we could call the buddhi, that kind of higher consciousness into kind of cohabitation with the realm of the body, which I didn't really have before Vipassana. I mean, I talked about my body as kind of like a blob that I didn't really know. And I was really excited when I was able to differentiate the top from the bottom. And then after Vipassana, it felt like there was this kind of meeting between the touch point of intellect and embodiment. And that's something that really meditation helped me find and ground. And I, you know, I processed a lot of old traumas. I processed a lot of things that I didn't even know were still kind of present within me. And since that first course that I did in Nepal after, I think it probably was like 2002 with my first course. And then I kept sitting. So I did another course and another course. I probably sat now, I don't know, like 8 courses, and I want to do another one next year. And I feel like it's a really, for me, the sitting practice is like, I sit twice a day, every day, but I don't do asanas every day and certainly not twice a day. So I feel like it's interesting in terms of how we think about the trajectory of our sitting practice, our meditation practice, the introspective practices. It's like, that's a practice you can continue for the rest of your life and it will get deeper and deeper and deeper. The results of which you will see in the interactions that you have in your life. But the asana practice, you know, maybe you don't go on an upward trajectory, you know, yeah. Maybe there's a plateau, maybe there's a change in internal awareness, but if we're measuring sort of like asana perfection by external aesthetic standards, there's going to be a point where, yeah, okay, if you, what you could do when you were 20, maybe you can still do, but differently and maybe adaptive when you're 90, you know, maybe mm-hmm. we get off of the asana achievement train, which I think is a healthy thing to get off of
yeah.
and understand what spiritual practice is, understand what are we cultivating within asana. So for me, the meditation practice has given me a depth, a place to kind of return home to, and has given me kind of a place to resolve many of the irresolutions within. And it's not like now it's perfect. I feel like, you know, I go through some stuff and then asana practice was wonderful for, you know, grounding and keeping a root and this sort of thing. But in my sitting practice is again, like I said, it's where I find my sanity. And I feel like with that, I can immediately see the difference if I don't sit just immediately, just that day itself. If for whatever reason I didn't sit, maybe there was a travel and like I arrive, then I feel there's a difference. Or if I feel like I'm going to give myself a holiday from sitting, and I'm like, yeah, maybe not actually, you know, maybe have a holiday after sitting is better for you. And there's also so much interesting research about how long-term sitting changes the neurobiology of your brain. And so that's something that I feel I have the lived experience of being a long-term sitting practitioner. And that's definitely, again, helped me just kind of soften the edges of asana as well and remove any sense of identity achievement from asana, to understand, oh, well, asana really helps in meditation, I feel, because look, you're going to sit. If your body is tight and it's uncomfortable for you to sit on the floor, it can be really helpful for you to like stretch your hips and become a little intimate with your body through the vehicle of asana. It's really going to help you be more comfortable when you sit on the floor. Mm-hmm. If you've got a lot of back pain and you're hunched over, and your psoas is really weak and stiff, then you're going to be in torture for, miserable, you know, a 1 hour sit. So please like take some asanas, and, you know, do something. Don't just sit there in misery. And I think it's really, really helpful, this combination. At the same time, the sitting practice really gives you the place to actually have a sort of forum where non-attachment is real, you know, and you can really practice letting go. So one of the things that I realized very quickly is that, look, in asana practice, we can injure ourselves, you know? So we're constantly like, am I pushing too hard? I better back off. Well, I should push a little more. Oh, no. So we're constantly like navigating the space. Injuries are real. Like people get injured, you know, you can injure yourself. You can get injured by a teacher. Your teacher can injure a student. It's unfortunate, but it happens. So it also happens in life. You can walk into a door and get a concussion, you know, like life is also dangerous. But in the sitting practice, I've had some really intense experience. Anybody who sits long-term will have similar experiences where there'll be pain, the kind of pain that you would experience in asana, but it doesn't lead to injury. It's really a temporary arising and passing of sensations. And if you were to experience that same pain in asana, you would immediately back away. But in sitting, you just sit and it dissipates. And then it's like this transformation that allows you to really get the experience. Oh, I am not my body. Mm-hmm. Oh, this body is a thing it's a gift I have. I'm inhabiting it, but I am not my body. And you can watch the thoughts in a way that we do in asana because we're doing something. The very fact of doing puts a layer between, you know, our thoughts and ourselves and our bodies and ourselves. So in the sitting practice, it's like, that's the place where I've had these realizations, the experiential realizations. Oh, I'm not my body. Oh, I'm not my mind, but I'm this watching consciousness that observes mind and body. And then what is that? And this is where it's interesting where, you know, like yoga and Buddhism have a conversation about what is the watching consciousness. So, you know, in the Buddha teachings, we'll say it's a Buddha nature. In the yoga teachings, we say it's Purusha. And it's like, well, we're saying the same thing with like different words. And then we can get into this whole kind of intellectual heady conversation about, well, the Buddha says there's no Atman. And then yoga says there is the Atman and it's the Purusha and the this. And I'm like, listen, just go and experience it. As soon as you realize it's not your body or not your mind, that feeling is what both of the disciplines are after, you know? Yeah. And then beyond that, we can try to put words for something that's ineffable. And this is where we get into trouble.
Yeah. I love that. It's the emptiness and the fullness, right? The shunyata, the emptiness, and then like the infinite, the ananta, the fullness. And it's just like this conversation, and the emptiness is infinite and the infinite is empty.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, the same thing. And I love that you bring up like the being and the doing. And I feel like sometimes we get really stuck in the being in the asana practice, or stuck in the doing in the asana practice, where we're like, I got to do this. I got to do this. You know, it's like a lot of action in a way, and it's a lot of effort and willpower and like doing of something to get somewhere or something or some experience. But then the meditation is kind of like the antidote in a sense. It's like the balancing, it's just the being. And there's really nothing you can do. And the more you try to do something in it, like the less it works in a weird way. So it's just a beautiful, it's beautiful, like complementary, I think, practices.
Hey there, it's Kino here. I just wanted to take a moment and thank you for tuning in to my show here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. Your support really means the world to me. I'm inspired by the fact that you're inspired and that you tune in each week and keep the inspiration to get on your mat and keep practicing and make the world a happier and more peaceful place. Remember, you can always practice with me on omstars.com. That's www.omstars.com. If you're inspired to read my books, you can check those out on any available online bookseller. Just search for my name, Kino McGregor. And my newest book called Get Your Yoga On is perfect for beginners. You can check that out. Otherwise, stay tuned and I'll see you next week.